There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Corporate Action.
Welcome to Corporate Action Bulletin, the official radio program and podcast of Corporate Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. I'm Rachel Hoop.
And I'm Chris Carafa. Julian Assange walked out of Belmarsh Prison in London on June 24th. As we're recording this episode, late on Tuesday, he is flying to the Northern Mariana Islands. And on Wednesday local time, he's expected to plead guilty to one federal charge in a U.S. federal court in exchange for a sentence of about 5 years' time served. He'll then return home to Australia to be with his wife, Stella, and his children, who have only seen him in jail after spending 1,901 days in Belmarsh and many years before that fighting for his freedom. To quote the official WikiLeaks account on Twitter, "Julian's freedom is our freedom." And it's true. The struggle for Julian Assange's freedom has been a global one, involving so many sectors of society, advocates and activists, whistleblowers, artists, human rights workers, doctors, and so many more. And of course, a brilliant team of lawyers all working tirelessly for his freedom. So today, we want to get a deeper understanding of what this all means. And I can't think of anyone better to have this conversation with than Kevin Gostola, the editor of The Dissenter, the author of the book, Guilty of Journalism, The Political Case Against Julian Assange, co-host of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, and so much more. Welcome back to the show, Kevin.
Hey, it's good to talk with you.
Well, great to be back with you because, you know, I looked it up. The last time you were on was in February. It was day X, the last time that you were on, when Assange, you know, had his hearing about extradition. And this news on Monday night, and we should say again, you know, this is extremely timely. We are recording this on Tuesday in the evening. It's about 5 o'clock Eastern time. Right now, Julian Assange just landed in the Northern Mariana Islands. He is expected to see a judge, I think, within hours. It is, I looked it up, it's about 7 a.m. there. Had to do, for the first time in my life, current time, Mariana Islands. But it's about 7 o'clock there. It's 5 o'clock Eastern on Tuesday as we're recording. This has been a whirlwind 24 hours, Kevin, since we found out that this plea deal had been agreed to. I was super excited when I got the news. I can't imagine how you were feeling. Just walk us through what you... how you heard about it, what your immediate response was first.
I did a live stream with, I think, friend of your show, John Kiriakou, and also a colleague of mine, Chip Gibbons, who's done some fantastic work on Espionage Act reform and coverage of the Assange case for Jacobin magazine. And we dug into this in real time, just taking in all that was coming out. You know, WikiLeaks is posting Julian Assange is free. And then shortly after, a video was posted and I got to see this incredible image that I don't think I imagined or gave myself the freedom to imagine was possible this year or next year. And it was Assange walking onto an airplane. He was no longer in Belmarsh Prison, the facility that it's nicknamed Britain's Guantanamo. And here he was. He had spent around 23 hours a day in a cell, very limited access to recreation. We know his health was deteriorating, and now he's walking. And for better or worse, he put on some weight, and he is headed to Saipan. He was headed to this U.S. Commonwealth Court, flying across the globe to the Pacific Ocean, islands in the Pacific Ocean, this Commonwealth country. I didn't know that the U.S. had Northern Mariana Island as part of its global empire, but I can't say that I know all of the islands in the Pacific Ocean. So it tested my knowledge and I failed because I had no idea that this was an option for Julian Assange. But part of why he went there was Julian Assange's refusal to make a trip to the continental United States to enter a plea, a guilty plea. So he was open to a plea deal, but not if it was going to take him to a U.S. courtroom in, say, Washington, D.C., or presumably he would have gone to Alexandria, Virginia, the Eastern District of Virginia, where he was charged. And he didn't want to go there because that is described as the espionage court. It is described as a court that you can get really favorable decisions for any national security case. So here's the alternative they came up with, that he could go to this Commonwealth nearby Australia. And then after he's done, I presume he'll be boarding an airplane to go return to his home. How long has it been since Julian Assange was in Australia? I was trying to estimate in my head, and I think it's probably been 10 plus, maybe 15 years. It's at least been 10 years.
Yeah, at least, I was thinking about this, at least a decade, without a doubt.
Maybe 15 years, because he spent a lot of time in the UK. He was in Iceland. But I suppose in between, he probably had chances to go back to Australia in between. Long time since he's been to his home country. And now this is his first chance at a life with Stella Assange, who he married while he was at Belmarsh. It's a first chance to be with his kids, free from guards looking over his shoulder, free from UC Global or the CIA spying on him in an embassy. He'll see Gabriel and Max and get to be their father without any intrusion from prison guards or U.S. spooks.
And this is exactly what the Department of Justice didn't want. They never wanted this to happen, but it was this movement globally that forced this to happen, where it became untenable to continue the extradition hearings. It became untenable for the U.S. to continue to demand that Assange be held in Belmarsh, as you mentioned, the Guantanamo of the UK. You know, I will say I'm looking at the flight logs for the plane that he is in, that he got to the Marinara Islands on, and it's supposed to take off in a few hours from now to go to Canberra. And, you know, maybe that's his flight, maybe it's not. You know, certainly hope that that'll be the case. And by the time folks hear this, he will be done and he will be gone. But you're right. I do want to mention, yeah, you're right. And our friend John Kiriakou often talks about the Eastern District of Virginia, that court, the espionage court, where if Assange did end up in that court, it is likely that things would have gone very, very differently for him. But I think that at this point, we don't want to make predictions. But I think that at this point, we can safely assume that by morning, U.S. time, Assange will be home with his kids and his wife for the first time in, certainly over a decade. I want to just ask Kevin, get into the details a little bit of what it is exactly that this plea agreement means. So the charge is 18 USC 793G, conspiracy to obtain and disclose national defense information. So conspiracy, of course, means two or more people. And Chelsea Manning is, of course, mentioned in this charge. But they are saying this is a 5-year time served sentence. This is under the Espionage Act, unfortunately. So this does mean that there is this prosecution and this agreement under the Espionage Act. So what do you make of that being the charge, them continuing with the Espionage Act charge, but that being the only charge?
So what's missing in the criminal information, and I put those in quotes, criminal information that had to be submitted as part of the plea deal, it's essentially what he pled guilty to. There aren't a lot of facts in there. Usually when you have a plea deal, there's something called a statement of facts. John Kiriakou had it in his case. Other whistleblowers, they have a statement of facts that they have to agree to in order to accept the plea deal. And, you know, in most of those cases, they're getting sentenced to prison and then they'll serve their sentence and they'll have some credit that they have to serve. Julian Assange already did the time, so he's going to be set free. The statement of this criminal information contains nothing about a password cracking conspiracy. You might have heard about this. Those people listening to your show might have heard this narrative that Julian Assange conspired with Chelsea Manning to crack a password to break into a military computer. There was never any basis for these allegations. I talked about it a lot. So did others who covered this, the half dozen or so journalists that regularly reported on this, like myself. We knew that this had all fallen apart, but it's not in this plea deal. Another thing missing, there is nothing about criminalizing the publication of materials on the internet. It's not in this plea deal. Plea deals are non-binding. They do not exist as something that prosecutors can hold up and then use as a precedent for going after another defendant for similar acts. So the Justice Department, for better or worse, will still be seeking that first case that convicts a publisher of classified documents under the Espionage Act. And I don't have any doubts. I don't have any doubts that if they can find somebody who is as difficult to defend as Julian Assange, that they will bring a case against that person and try to expand their prosecutorial power. But what I'll say about this plea deal is that as an outcome, it is the least worst, or it avoids a worst possible outcome, which is to come to the United States, to be extradited to the U.S., and to be put on trial for 17 Espionage Act charges, as well as that computer crime offense, the conspiracy to commit a computer crime offense. And so this is an outcome that Julian Assange and the whole global movement, as you were saying in the setup to our conversation, it has to be celebrated. It has to be recognized as a victory. And I think some of what led to this victory is this appeal hearing that was coming on July 9th and 10th. It was scheduled. The high court granted this appeal on one limited issue, but an important issue. The issue was that Julian Assange would likely be prejudiced due to his nationality, the fact that he's not a U.S. citizen, if he was put on trial. And they were going to hear argument over whether the First Amendment applied to Julian Assange if he was in a U.S. courtroom, if he was on trial. And part of the problem was the European Convention on Human Rights has an article, Article 10, freedom of expression, that covers freedom of expression. And there is no requirement. It's not tied to the nationality of the person. So it's meaning that you don't have to be a EU or a European Union citizen to have these human rights protections. If you are prosecuted, it's my understanding, you just have these European human rights extended to you in court. That's not the case in the United States. Even the Supreme Court has ruled that people with no ties to the United States do not have to be extended constitutional rights. So that would include First Amendment. You get due process rights. You get things like habeas corpus, but you don't get the benefit of the First Amendment, which would hamper any challenge to being prosecuted under the Espionage Act. And, you know, obviously I'm aware that there are legal issues. I don't know that we have to spend a lot of time going into the weeds, but there are legal issues because in the past, whistleblowers have challenged the Espionage Act from the standpoint of it violating their First Amendment rights. Although Julian Assange was in a different position. He's the journalist. Whistleblowers are the source. So Julian Assange receiving information is different than those whistleblowers having access to the information and then disclosing it to a news media organization. That's how I'll conclude by just saying, I think that this is a victory. We need to give ourselves permission to celebrate it as a victory. You take the day, take the rest of the week, because this case has gone on for almost 15 years, and then come back tomorrow and recognize that the struggle for freedom of the press will continue, and there will be other targets. There will be other people who the U.S. government sets their sights on, and we'll need to stand up and defend against the government's effort to define, redefine what it means to be a journalist.
Certainly, Kevin, there is so much to get into here, but I definitely couldn't agree more. It's time to take a moment to celebrate before we launch into all the other things that we could be launching into, because it's 15 years of dedicated, consistent action all around the globe that led to this moment. If Julian Assange was arrested and there was no outcry, there was no public movement, there was no real kind of undertaking of the movement everywhere in the globe to make Assange's cases the one that needs to be talked about in relationship to press freedom, I mean, who knows where we would be? I mean, it's very possible that Assange would have been forced to plea out to a much worse deal many, 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 many years ago, in a much worse condition without the kind of knowledge that we've gotten along the way. I mean, I think this case has brought forward what the United States government is willing to do. I think it's really exposed so much of the way that the U.S. wants to control the narrative and the lengths at which it will go to control the narrative. But I really want to ask you this, Kevin, and I really appreciate the way that you frame this as being a defeat for the national security state, because I do see it that way as well. I think that it's not only a win for Assange and a win for the movement, but we do see that this has been a ability to push back against what the U.S. government has unlimited power to do. So I'm curious, kind of your thoughts in this, some of the other geopolitics that play here that played a role. I think a lot of the pressure from Australia and the pressure that was created by citizens on their governments to then put pressure in this situation played quite a role here. So I'm curious some of your thoughts on how the U.S. had to be put on the back foot and how that happened.
Yeah, so I already mentioned the possibility of this appeal hearing not working out in the U.S. government's favor. And if we're going to address that in a geopolitical manner, the U.S. government doesn't want it to become harder to pursue extraditions. So if they find that people who are facing extradition in the European Union, not just the U.K., are now able to say, hey, okay, I did this terrorism offense or whatever, but you send me to the United States, I'm not going to have First Amendment rights. So that means I'm going to be prejudiced due to my nationality. And if that's something that is entertained by the court system that governs all of these extraditions, the U.S. government's going to have a difficult time with the way that everything is managed in the United States. So I don't think they really wanted that. And I'm crudely representing this. I know that there are finer details in the law that someone who was a lawyer could probably capture more elegantly. But then you look at Australia and you look at the movement of people there, the campaign, the Assange defense campaign, the people on the ground who stood up and forced their government to make an issue. The Australian government is a client state of the U.S. They're a close diplomatic ally, and they don't really want to have friction with the U.S. government. They have partnerships. They receive military equipment. They're expected to help out with countering Chinese influence in the Pacific region. So they don't really want to have to make this an issue. However, their citizens, Australians, they stood up and forced the Prime Minister and Parliament to demand that the U.S. government end this case. And I have to believe that it played some significant role in this outcome. It's also possible that the will of Julian Assange to fight this case was more steadfast than the will and appetite of the Biden administration and people in the National Security Division of the Justice Department to keep on fighting for these charges. So they were looking at a timeline, and probably he could be someday brought to the U.S. and put on trial, but they were going to have to wait another 3 to 5 years if you just looked at how things shook out. I tend to imagine that the European Court of Human Rights would have accepted this petition and reviewed the case and decided whether they thought he should be extradited or not. And so maybe in 2026, 2027, they finally get to put Julian Assange on trial if they had continued this case. I just don't think they wanted to spend the resources and time on Julian Assange anymore. And so we're here, his legal team representing him, and then lawyers from the Justice Department, they meet, they hammer out a transaction. Plea deals are coercive. They always are. But in this case, I think there was actually a mutual interest in ending the case. You know, obviously the interest on the part of Julian Assange is not dying in Belmarsh prison, not having his health further deteriorate, not being further isolated from his family, friends, and colleagues. And then on the other side, for the Justice Department, it's, this is not working for the United States government. We're getting backlash. It's harder to defend press freedom. It's harder to speak about press freedom cases. Just look at the case of Evan Gershkovich in Russia, who is detained. In my view, it's a mirror image of Julian Assange's case, not in the sense that like Julian Assange was working for Russia, because there's no evidence that he ever was working for Russian intelligence. But Vladimir Putin's argument about Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich is that he was working for the CIA. And there has been no evidence, to my knowledge, ever put forward that he was investigating the flow of military equipment or the production of military weaponry for the war in Ukraine for the CIA. But there was no evidence in Julian Assange's case. And essentially, Putin says that Gershkovich was collecting state secrets. Biden and Trump and officials at the Justice Department accused Julian Assange of collecting state secrets through WikiLeaks. And so, to me, it was like a battle of these countries that don't want to be held accountable by anyone, whether it's their own citizens protesting or it's their press, the media organizations that report on their criminality and wrongdoing. And now you make Julian Assange's case go away. I'm not here to boost the U.S. government and say that their image is repaired. It's not. But do you know that next week and the month after, when Evan Gershkovich's case comes up, one of the things the Russian government can't say to them is, well, hey, we get to jail Evan Gershkovich because you jailed Julian Assange because you tried to bring him to trial. I mean, it kind of falls away. It sort of removes a bit of propaganda that adversaries of the U.S. empire and other countries around the world would have. And, you know, I mean this as somebody who cares about human rights. I don't want to take, I'll conclude by saying, I don't want to take the U.S. government at their word and say that if they just create this illusion that they care about human rights, we should just believe in everything they say and that we don't need to see actions. But the other flip side is that I don't want to see what the U.S. government does be this race to the bottom that empowers dictators and authoritarian regimes to trample over their citizens and to attack journalists who are, you know, in my profession, they're my colleagues. They're people like us that are trying to do work to investigate power, presumably also to inform people of what's going on in war zones, in their communities, etc. And so the idea that anything the U.S. government was doing would make the world more hostile for journalism, that has come to an end, is probably one of the most positive aspects of this plea deal.
Definitely, Kevin. You know, one of the things as you're talking, I'm thinking about too, is the United States government. I can't imagine Julian Assange's case and like having a whole trial come up in the context of the U.S. banning TikTok, in the context of the kind of suppression that we've seen of the media in the recent years since October 7th, since the uprising of People for Palestine. I just think that I can't imagine that there isn't also a connection there, that the U.S. already looks so bad in the eyes of the public. The lack of trust is already there. Do they really want to en masse then educate a group of people who's been in motion since what's been going on in Palestine? There's this whole new group, new wave, especially of young people who are becoming politicized, who are joining the movement, who are getting involved. Do we really want to bring this case in front of them in that way? Because it could really blow up in a different direction. So I wouldn't be surprised if there weren't other calculations there, too. You never know exactly why people are making the choices that they're making when it comes to those in power. But I can't help but feel very strongly that the movement, whenever it's on an upswing, we get wins, and there's a reason for that. But Chris, I know there's a lot you want to get in here on too.
Yeah, one of the things I want to talk about, I just really appreciate your time so far with us, Kevin, but I want to talk about the way that this has been covered in the media in the last few days. I got an email from our friend John Kiriakou last night, and that's how I found out about this. And it just said, Assange to be freed. And I was like, whoa, what? I stopped what I was doing. But, you know, I didn't get an alert notification, and I get notifications for all sorts of things from like Apple News. Like I get like, you know, this team won the World Cup and who, you know, Stanley Cup, whatever it is, things I don't really care about. And they just all, you know, they're pushed. But this is not coming to my phone from any of the outlets that I subscribe to. So I'm just doing some quick searching right now. New York Times, they have two stories about Assange, but you have to scroll about halfway down the page and it's under 22 of the best pizza places in the United States. So clearly that story more important to them. Washington Post, live coverage of the hearing. Le Monde, it's in this most read section, but not actually anywhere on like the front page. There's no images of Assange. The Guardian, again, it is on the front page, from a plea deal to a 2 a.m. prison call. Der Spiegel, there's like a little like widget at the top, but no real major coverage. El País, it's on the front page there. And I picked those five. And I think, Kevin, you know why I picked those five outlets. There are so many outlets that benefited so much in the West. And I'm including all five of these and so many more, from what Julian Assange helped to expose, what WikiLeaks put out to the world in terms of not just the war crimes of the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan, but so much more, the cables that were put out, the documents, everything, and the way they did it in such a way that was cautious. And some people even said overly cautious. That's up to them, whatever. But they were professional about it. They were very serious about it. These premier top tier news outlets worked on it. You know, when they put that statement out a few years ago saying, you know, we're calling for the freedom of Assange, it, of course, was a very necessary and needed thing. I think it was a little late, but it was very necessary and needed. But now, half of them barely even covering it, and certainly not covering it in the way that it needs to be covered in terms of analyzing what this means for their own reporters and for, yes, as you're talking about, for press freedom worldwide. I mean, how are you looking at the lack of significant coverage, actually, I think, in Western media, not just English language, but, you know, as I said, you know, in El País and other places?
Generally, I respond to the media's coverage of the outcome here in a way that makes me feel like there's something macabre or almost perverse about the news media establishment. It's as if this isn't the way they wanted the story to go. I'm not suggesting that they wanted Julian Assange to be convicted, but they're not going to get a trial in the United States that could produce a lot of coverage and give them the ability to talk endlessly about someone they treated as a weirdo and will continue to treat as a weirdo and freak, however you want to describe him. There are some things about him that no matter how much they try, they can't help themselves. They have to speak it, even though it is totally irrelevant. Speaking about sexual allegations against him from Sweden, I mean, we're done with those. Like that came and went. It was dealt with. And the Swedish prosecution authority, they opened and closed the case at least three or four times. And they just, if it was serious enough, I would have hoped they would have tried to question Julian Assange and the embassy on behalf of the people who accused him of sexual misconduct. They can't stop talking about the Democratic Party and Clinton campaign emails that were published in 2016. I watched a clip on CNN of Sarah Seidner, who's an anchor, and she said that she had to mention, she said, I just have to mention these Clinton campaign emails because they played a role. And then in the same breath said, but actually they're not part of the charges at all. So they didn't play a role. They didn't play a role at all. And you know, the reason why they didn't play a role is you could be a Clinton Democrat or a liberal Democrat hack on CNN and just say, Donald Trump's Justice Department didn't care about Julian Assange publishing Clinton campaign emails. What they wanted to nail Julian Assange for, Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Mike Pompeo, was publishing the cables from the State Department, the war logs from Iraq and Afghanistan, the detainee assessment reports on the Guantanamo Bay prisoners. So that's easy to understand. Okay, then quickly, as you were saying about these organizations that have coverage, you were naming these five organizations. These are media partners. WikiLeaks worked with dozens of media, but there were five, six that they gave almost all their documents to. They were freely sharing access. I just want to share with you something that David Sanger of the New York Times, their national security correspondent, said on CNN. I have this before me from the transcript. He says that Assange's case was different and more complicated. Why? He was not a U.S. government employee. Okay, that's true. And he wasn't a U.S. citizen. So he never made commitments to keep information secret. That's correct, David. But then here's where he gets it wrong. He says he also wasn't a journalist. He was taking this data and just throwing everything out there because WikiLeaks had this sort of anarchic concept of full transparency. He didn't do what I think you and I would consider what journalists do. Sift through material, figure out what's important, exercise some judgment about what you publish and what you don't, excise the names of people whose lives could be at risk. Those are all things that we and other news organizations went and did. Now, there are two things to say about that, which is one, the law does not criminalize you if you engage in irresponsible journalism. The law is that I can publish documents however I please. That's my First Amendment right. If I get something and I think it's in the public interest and I publish it, and then later on you say that I was reckless, that was unethical for me to share that information, especially if it wasn't my intent to ruin those people's lives. Let's just say there's private information in there. I didn't do a good job of cleaning it up and doctoring it so that I could not ruin some people's lives. Well, I did a bad thing, ethically speaking, but I didn't commit a crime that deserves me to be put on trial and then forever upend my life. And then the other thing is, none of this stuff is true. But also, he's not sifting through the material. He's not figuring out what's important. He's not exercising judgment because he's brought in these media organizations that are better equipped to look at the information and make them into news articles that could be shared with the public. So WikiLeaks, what was incredible about the moment in 2010 and 2011 was WikiLeaks has the documents. WikiLeaks puts the documents in databases on their websites. We all get to access that information, but we also get to see news media organizations go through that material and find scoops in those documents and report stories that then create a fallout or a response from those governments as they're responding to revelations. And sometimes we get to see the kind of propaganda and or biases of these media outlets as they decide that these documents are not important, but these documents are. We want to cover North Korea and Iran. We don't want to talk about coup in Honduras. We don't want to talk about drone strikes in Yemen and so on and so forth. And that was the genius of going to these different media outlets and trying to have the highest impact possible. Partnering with these different media organizations gave WikiLeaks the ability to not just give documents to the crowd, to not just give files to a bunch of random people out there in some hacker space, but to allow professionals, academics, scholars, historians, all different types of intellectuals to dig into this material and then share this knowledge and also help people understand what was in the documents. And today, I still would maintain that we don't know everything that's in these sets of documents that Julian Assange was prosecuted over and which destroyed his life, upended him, and forever altered his physical and mental health. We don't know. And there's still work to be done, and we'll continue to go into this material to help us understand events in Russia, in Gaza, Israel, in Venezuela, you name the country that the U.S. empire has policy making and operations that they are engaged in, then we can use this material to better understand U.S. actions.
Definitely, Kevin. You know, I definitely feel like to call Julian Assange not a journalist is just so highly offensive on every level. I mean, number one, because he doesn't editorialize what he's put out, then therefore he is not a journalist. Who gets to be a gatekeeper for what journalism is? I mean, why is it that the corporate media and the kind of journalism corporate media produces, why is that legitimate? But then, you know, which essentially a lot of times has fake sources or just, you know, the sources say, but it's just police or State Department officials. Why is that considered real journalism? And yet the exposing, the true exposing of the crimes of the U.S. empire, that's not. I mean, I just feel so heated over that as a comment, just to put it out there. But I do think you bring us to a good point here as we get to our close, Kevin. I feel very strongly that it cannot be understated the kind of importance that the work of Julian Assange, what it's brought to us as a movement, as a people. I really feel firmly that so much of what Assange has put out, especially on the Iraq War, especially on the U.S. interventions abroad, how much that's changed and shaped the perspectives of the U.S. public. And it's so parasitic for these organizations, these organizations who made money off of what he did. He was the one who went out and found these sources. He worked with others and they organized, they came together to be able to create these important publications, make this happen. And there were journalists at mainstream publications who made their careers off of this. It's so parasitic to then not turn around and be able to actually not only actively fight, got in the fight very late. I'm glad that they got in the fight, but they got in very late, but to benefit so greatly off of what he has done and yet to turn a blind eye. And even now with the kind of reporting that we're getting, I think that it just shows to me the power of narrative, the power that the media has to tell a very specific narrative. And when we don't celebrate wins, when we don't frame things as wins, when we don't recognize what it took to get here, we are creating and further entrenching this idea that the movement always loses, that we're always on the back foot, that there are no gains, that there are no wins, when that isn't true. And I think that that's part of the reason why I feel that the media is reporting it this way. It wasn't the blowout, bang out kind of real reality TV show thing that they were looking for in regards to a trial or whatever the fallout might be. But it wasn't the sexiness of what the media was hoping for. And so they really didn't have much interest other than informational interest of saying, well, this thing happened, because they don't have the same interests. Corporate media does not have the same interests as independent media does, as journalists do. People that are really doing this work and recognize the importance of it, it's not the same. But anyways, I could go on that point. But Kevin, I do want to get your kind of final thoughts on this. I mean, as I'm reflecting, you know, this is the end of an era, so to speak. I mean, there really is so much that went into the fight to see Julian Assange free. Obviously, there are still, there's a precedent that's been set. There is going to be struggles in the future. This doesn't close the era of press freedoms. But what's next for the dissenter? What's next for all of the work that you've been doing in particular? And where do you see the fight for press freedoms going?
What you were saying means a lot to me about how you have to recognize that you derived some benefit from Assange and WikiLeaks. and you can't be parasitic. And the way that I avoided simply just leeching off of WikiLeaks was to take an interest in the case against Chelsea Manning, the military court-martial. And then as it happened, and I honestly was not prepared for it, when Julian Assange was expelled and arrested April 11th, 2019, it wasn't like I was following everything closely and knew ahead of time that this was coming. I certainly wasn't doing a good enough job talking to sources and anticipating that everything had soured, so Julian Assange was going to be tossed out and then detained in prison. And so I benefited from publishing stories about WikiLeaks cables, doing writing about the Warlock documents. And I understood that naturally the next thing would be to take interest in these cases, these Espionage Act prosecutions, President Barack Obama's larger war on whistleblowers, and then to help people understand how attacks on whistleblowers could so quickly develop into attacks on freedom of the press. That these whistleblowers are sources we need to recognize. They're not, like, when they leak and they reveal information to the press, it is important what they're doing as an individual, but they're also part of the news ecosystem, and we depend on sources in order to know what's happening with both U.S. foreign policy, military operations, national security operations, and also domestic policy as well. And it's crucial for us to protect and defend these sources. So going forward, I would just say that I'm going to continue to connect all these struggles for freedom of the press together, and to remember the people who were there, who supported my work, like your show, other shows that invited me on to cover Julian Assange's case. And I'll just take a moment to end by recognizing a few people who are not here with us to celebrate this moment. I wrote a book, Guilty of Journalism, The Political Case Against Julian Assange. I'm thrilled. It's now a history book. I don't have to go around with it, wave it as a warning. This is something we have to stop. We have to prevent. Julian Assange is free. People who supported the book and also supported my work who are not here today and were mentors for Julian Assange, I'm disappointed that they didn't get to see this and celebrate. Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg unfortunately died of pancreatic cancer last year, almost exactly a year ago, a little bit more, and missed out on seeing Julian Assange walk free. There's an American journalist who did a lot of work in the UK, Gavin McFadden. He knew Matt Kennard of Declassified UK, and he was a supporter of Assange and WikiLeaks, and he died before Julian Assange was freed. Michael Ratner was a human rights attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, a part of the WikiLeaks legal team. He supported my work on the Manning court-martial, but he died before Julian Assange was arrested and before Julian Assange could step out of the Ecuador embassy and be a free man. And I think of them. And John Pilger was a international journalist, covered Gaza, reported on U.S. imperialism, and a great supporter of Julian Assange. And they're not alive to celebrate. And so that's part of the passage of time. We talk about what has happened to Julian Assange, but there were people in our lives, there are colleagues that were around, there are activists in the world of the Assange defense campaign that are no longer alive, who I want people to know were going out every single day. Nobody knew who they were. They didn't get any money. They didn't get any personal reward for being out there in the cold protesting in support of Julian Assange. They would wait in line. I'll close with this story. One of the greatest human acts that I know about from this case is that there were Assange supporters in London who would get up at 3:30 or 4 a.m. in the morning and go stand outside of the courthouse where Julian Assange was going through extradition proceedings. And they would hold positions for people who worked at human rights organizations and press freedom groups who were denied seats in court. And they would give their seat. They would stand there for 2 or 3 hours in the cold rain, and then they would leave and they let somebody else have the spot when it was time to go into court. And I just think of those people, all of the everyone out there who has been so generous and supportive. And that's the kind of thing, building this community, we'll all have to come together. I didn't say it. I have to say it before we close. Unfortunately, this is kind of something that is infuriating, but we need to know this. Julian Assange has to foot the bill for his charter flight to Australia. He owes £520,000. That works out to pretty close to $500,000 that he owes for this charter flight.
It's $640,000 approximately.
It's even more. It's even more money because the exchange rate goes the other way.
Half of it has already been raised in the course of about 12 hours. About half of that has already been crowdfunded, which just shows the appreciation that people have for him.
That's the movement that was built. And that's the movement that was also going to help contribute to his health and recovery fund. And I don't know if WikiLeaks is going to work again, if they're going to start accepting submissions and be able to publish leaks. Julian Assange made a comment to a journalist that wrote an article for The Nation. His name's Charles Glass, made a comment about how he was disappointed that WikiLeaks could no longer do the work of exposing war crimes. And his comment was connected to, you know, it was his response to Charles Glass asking about how WikiLeaks would be very useful at this time, given the events with the war on Gaza and also the war in Ukraine. And I know that he would like WikiLeaks to make an impact again and be engaging in this groundbreaking journalism. I also know that Julian Assange has gone through so much. So it doesn't really make a difference to me what happens. But now that we don't have to spend, after this week, we're raising money now for Julian Assange. But after we can move on and no longer expend funds and resources defending Julian Assange, there's going to be a lot that people can unite around as far as independent media and as far as fights for freedom of expression broadly. You know, protests, organizing, and in journalism as well. And I just hope people remember, I've seen somebody say this. I think this is a good way for me to end my comments. You knew about Julian Assange as a political prisoner. Familiarize yourself with other people who are also incarcerated under similar circumstances. And once you're able to recharge and you're ready to go out there and fight again, maybe think of those people who haven't received the attention that Assange has received and throw yourself on that cause and see what you can do to help them find freedom.
Certainly, Kevin, so much more to say. I want to say certainly thank you for all the years of your work and all of the work of everyone you've mentioned and spoken about. I mean, it really has been important that this movement was cultivated, that there were people consistently reporting along the way on the right side of history. So there really is so much to say. And I will say this, the movement doesn't end here. I mean, you know, it's a good time to take a rest, take a break, celebrate. But like you mentioned, yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of NewsClick's founder and editor-in-chief, Prabir, who is still dealing with all that he is dealing with, being arrested and being persecuted by the Indian government. So there still are journalists behind bars. There are still journalists who have cases that need to be worked out. There are still so much more that we can do on the front of press freedoms. But either way, we are going to have to leave it right there. We have been joined by Kevin Gustola, the editor of The Dissenter, the author of the now history book, Guilty of Journalism, The Political Case Against Julian Assange, and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure, and so much more. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kevin.
Thank you.
We are going to have to leave it right there. Before you go, if you did like what you hear today and you do want to support our specific independent journalism, you can go to patreon.com/covertactionmagazine and become a patron. We can only do the support with the support of our listeners. So thank you so much to all of our patrons who already support us. You've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin. I'm Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Garaffa. Covert Action Bulletin is the official show of Covert Action Magazine and is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York. If you missed any of our episodes, you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts by searching for Covert Action Bulletin or listen on your station's archive. So we are all out of time for today. Thanks for listening to Covert Action Bulletin.
Covert Action.
Greetings. WPFW presents Reversing the Mounting Healthcare Access Crisis for DC's Underserved, a radio forum on Unity Healthcare Clinics and the DC Jail, a special broadcast spotlighting the importance of community involvement and government support on Tuesday, July 9th, 6 to 8 p.m. Participants include Unity Healthcare providers representing their newly formed union, DC City Council members, community activists, and WPFW hosts. Produced in collaboration with the Union of American Physicians and Dentists, that's Reversing the Mounting Healthcare Access Crisis for DC's Underserved, a radio forum on the Unity Healthcare Clinics and the DC Jail. Tuesday, July 9th, 6 to 8 p.m. on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Born in 1899, Edward Kennedy Ellington ranks as the greatest all-around figure, composer, arranger, orchestrator, bandleader, conductor, piano accompanist, soloist, and musical thinker. On Thursday, July 11th, from 5 a.m. until midnight, WPFW honors Ellington on the occasion of his 125th birth year with Ellington 125, a celebration beyond category. We will tickle the sonic keys with all things Ellington, from his three-minute instrumentals to his theatrical scores and sacred concerts, all in support of building our relocation fund. That's Ellington 125, a celebration beyond category. Thursday, July 11th, from 5 a.m. until midnight on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
PACA, Pan-African Community Action, will be holding the Community Town Hall, The Harm of Crime Bills, and the Future of Community Power in Chaka City. On Saturday, July 13th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., D.C. residents are invited to discuss how the Secure D.C. Crime Bill targets the black working class and criminalizes our youth, and how to develop real people-centered solutions to community safety. There will be speakers, group exercises, lunch, and a performance by the Afro-Go-Go Roots Collective, Crank Lukongo Unplugged. The Harm of Crime Bills and the Future of Community Power in Chocolate City, Saturday, July 13th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the RISE Demonstration Center, 2730 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More information and registration can be found online, PACA, that's P-A-C-A, crimebilltownhall.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings, here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
Thank you for listening to the just completed program. If you'd like to offer feedback on any of our programming, please email us at info@wpfw.org.
Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. A coalition of France's left and center-left parties won a majority of parliamentary seats, delivering a defeating blow to the far right that was projected to win weekend elections. Thousands rallied to celebrate in the streets of Paris and other cities with fireworks and chants Sunday. As the National Popular Front coalition won 182 seats. President Emmanuel Macron's centrist party won 168, with a far-right national rally in third place, receiving 143 seats. The left coalition failed to garner enough votes to win an outright majority. It's asked President Emmanuel Macron and the prime minister to resign. Macron is keeping the two in power for now. If the left and center cannot reach alliance, the nation faces a political gridlock, which would be unprecedented. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, head of France's unbowed leftist party, hailed their win.
Un magnifique élan de mobilisation civique s'est affirmé.
He said a magnificent surge of civic mobilization has taken hold. Our people have clearly rejected the worst-case scenario. Tonight, the National Rally Party is far from having the absolute majority commentators were predicting. The coalition, which also includes Greens, has pledged to raise the minimum wage and roll back unpopular pension reforms by Macron that increase the age of retirement. President of France Unbowed in Parliament, Mathilde Panot, told media they will recognize Palestine as a state in the coming weeks. A reformist candidate won Iran's runoff presidential election Saturday, the AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
Iran reformist Masoud Pereshkian, a heart surgeon and lawmaker, beat hardliner Saeed Jalili by promising to reach out to the West and ease enforcement on the country's mandatory headscarf rules. People in Iran's capital Tehran share their reactions to the news. Taxi driver Mohammed Sharif Najad tells the AP, everyone is a bit more glad, adding Pereshkian should ease the economic pressure in the country. I just want a normal life, but I can't make ends meet. I'm always in debt. While local resident Mahmoud Mohammadi says to lift the sanctions, Pereshkian should first reach an agreement with world powers and see what their demands and our demands are. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
President Joe Biden tried to defend his record over the weekend and today with radio and TV interviews to show the nation of his cognitive ability after an abysmal debate with Donald Trump last month. Still, Biden used teleprompter during his ABC appearance and asked certain questions on two radio stations that were scripted by his campaign. House Republicans are now calling for a hearing on Biden's cognitive decline and who, if any, has tried to withhold information from the public about it. In a letter sent to congressional Democrats today, Biden rejected any calls to step down and said if anyone wants to challenge him, they could do so at the Democratic National Convention next month in Chicago. Officials in Ukraine say Russian missile attacks killed at least 31 people and injured 154 across the country. One missile struck a large children's hospital in the Ukrainian capital Kiev, killing at least seven. Talks on a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip are expected to resume this week. Several officials say Hamas has softened its demands after 9 months of war. Hamas has appeared to drop its long-standing demand Israel promised to end the war as part of any ceasefire deal. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says Israeli negotiators will resume talks this week with Hamas. Israeli forces have deepened an operation in Gaza Strip's largest city, Gaza City, forcing thousands of Palestinians to flee the area that was ravaged in the early weeks of the 9-month-long war. The military says it's meant to